my shadow. My shadow always follows me, no matter where I go. He follows when I'm walking fast and when I'm walking slow. I know he doesn't like getting wet. He hides when we have rain. But soon as that old sun comes out, there he is again. I don't know who will have my shadow now that I can't see, but I hope he'll stay as close to them as he stayed close to me.
Thank you very much, Horace. That was wonderful. Thank you, and hopefully we'll have time at the end for the Dimmock Bobby as well, which is a very funny poem. So I would now to introduce Amy Key. Amy Key's debut collection is called Lux, and her poems have appeared in magazines and anthologies, including Poetry, The Poetry Review, Love Poems, a Faber anthology, and she has edited an anthology of poems on friendship between women called Best Friends Forever, which was published by the Emma Press. Really lovely press. A pamphlet, History, is also out with If a Leaf Falls Press. She edits Poems in Which, that's an online journal, and I really do think she's a wonderful activist for poetry, as well as a really splendid poet, and that's a lovely, generous thing, I think. So I'm really delighted to welcome Amy Key.
Thank you, Chloe, and thank you, Horace. I don't use rhyme in my poetry, hardly ever, and I hope by the time I'm your age, I'll have mastered it, but I think, you know, it's going to take me a lot of effort to do that. Does anybody ever pick up a vegetable and suddenly go into raptures about the extraordinary beauty of a vegetable? Am I alone in this? Maybe it's an eccentricity, but this is a bit of an ode to vegetables. Oh, you most beautiful inside of a vegetable. I want to rid myself of these tender thoughts. The red cabbage I sliced through, the inside half shining like an Italian bathroom, the baroque feeling of a recent pineapple after I chopped off its crown and for a moment wore it as a hat. How can I live my life when even a radish transforms into a trinket grief? It is impractical to attach oneself to anything edible. I now find myself separating the leaves of a blousy English lettuce, leaves I want to press to my cheek like a cool flannel on a childhood fever. Apologies to the contents of the salad drawer. I don't suppose many of you are familiar with me or my online presence, but I thought it was useful to share that my online presence is 90% cats. I have two cats, and I was always told that you should not put cats in poems, you shouldn't write poems about cats or Hitler, and I just couldn't help myself. Two cats. Cat one sat at the window, where recently I'd moved a small sky blue Formica table. She looked out through the gaps in condensation, which resembled a puckering like stretch marks. Her fascination, small birds, occasional insects. The vet had diagnosed her as anxious and depressed. And though this caused me great shame, I like to think when at the window, she had a sense of peace and better understood her part in the world. Cat two restricted herself to my bed in the crease between duvet and pillows. Sometimes I'd come home to tufts of fur on the bedspread, and I couldn't be sure who it belonged to. That the cats might hate each other was a concern. I whispered love to both cats and tried to pay them equal attention. The vet prescribed a hormone diffuser to take the edge off their fretfulness, but I began to worry about its effect on me. I had trouble both sleeping and waking and was often in tears. Cat 2 seemed to sense this and would settle on top of me, pinning me into a dream, while Cat 1 lay on the sofa, grooming herself obsessively, like someone enslaved to their New Year's resolutions. Okay, I want to read the poem from the Lebri anthology, and I forgot. Huat. Huat? Huat, okay. So I have a poem in there which is really lovely, and it's something that I stitched together from tweets that I tweeted on Twitter. That's a nice bit of alliteration for you if you don't find enough poetic elements of alliteration in my poetry. And it's all about my unrequited loves. An abecedary of unrequited love. Unrequited love for auto-connecting to your Wi-Fi. Unrequited love for being looked at with faux disapproval. For cornichons, derelict swimming pools, extreme pallor. Unrequited love for first name, last name symmetry. Unrequited love for girls curling their eyelashes on the top deck. His strange weather, imaginary boyfriends, junk foods made a comeback. Unrequited love for Kirby grips, Lee Miller's selfies, my own meta-narrative. Unrequited love for no fixed ideal, for optic measures, for paint tester pots, for queenliness. Unrequited love for ring pull cans, sexually aggressive mixtape song choices, teen talk, unexpected cover versions, Valley Girls. Unrequited love for waving at wrist height to someone standing next to you. Wear your clothes, pretend I was you and lose control. Wear your pink glove all the time, water slides. When someone on a bicycle bumps into a friend on a bicycle and they try to hug without getting off their bicycles. Unrequited love for xylophones. Unrequited love for your salvage yard eyes. Unrequited love for Zelda Fitzgerald, who died in a fire while awaiting electroshock therapy. 9 women, including Zelda, died that day. The last week, the last year, the last decade, however your political persuasion is, have been kind of extraordinary. And sometimes it's been very hard to, well, for me personally, to have hope for the future. And last year after the general election, Bill Herbert and Andy Jackson did a project where for the first 100 days after the election, they asked poets to respond. And this is my response, which now seems even more important, I guess. Not my poem, just the kind of act of writing political poetry. To dream of copper denotes oppression from those above you in station. Your dream denotes sorrow and vexation. Some deceitful person has installed himself at the heights of prosperity. Unhappy conditions are piled thick around you. Enemies are circulating detrimental reports. Your dreams are abandoned. They are abandoned in that you will have difficulty framing your plans for future success. Little sustenance will be eked out by your own labours. You will suffer for another's wild folly. No good will come from this dream. It foretells an event will cast a sickening fear of living around you. You will find yourself tangled in meshes of perplexity, the victim of nervous troubles. A withering state of things bodes no well for the dreamer. Your dream is significant of a chronic stage. Enemies will chase your every effort. You will suffer exasperating gloom. Loss will be added to unconquerable griefs. After a season of disquiet, rioting will follow. Your dream is not always a bad dream. It signifies opposition to enemies' workings against you. If you dream your sympathies are enlisted for the sorrows of others, true friends will attend you. Those in power will lose. Okay. I'm going to read a poem from my book. I'm in the tight dress, the one that prevents dignified sitting. The tight dress suggests I'm prepared to be undressed. Do my thighs flash through the seams? I try to remember if the bed is made or unmade. The wind is wrapping up the sound of our kissing. I wonder, should I undress first, or should you undress first? I'm not sure I can take off the dress in a way that looks good. I consider if I should save up sex until morning. We are far gone, and I'm better at kissing when sober. I find that your earlobes provide the current fascination. On my bedside table are 3 glasses of water and my favourite love letter. I try to untie your shoes in a way that is appalling. So this is a bit of an alter ego poem. And it's built around the idea of going on silent retreat. I have this Buddhist friend, and she goes on silent retreat. And I'm kind of fascinated and horrified by this idea of being left with oneself. So I have this constant struggle between wanting to be alone and wanting to be around people. So I invented Delphine. Delphine is on silent retreat. Delphine is snug in the corruptible quiet, her heart all lurgy. She is vigorous with postures and slackening her jaw. The vogue memory is how, when she was 10, she stuck her tongue out really far and her friend said, "That makes you a lemon." Retrospectively, what she wanted was a perm and a dad that gave money for the arcade. Delphine lies down in the corner and gets up and lies down again, etc. This is so she knows she's laid down on every bit of the floor. There's no one to see, so makeup is taken very seriously. If she French kisses the window, her hair starts to curl. It is all very boudoir. Delphine expected to be bored. What she needs to say aloud is smooch. Delphine's heart is more woolen than shore. She nipped off the fir buds from the pussy willow and strung them into a necklace, a means of clustering wants. In the faraway land, her old milk glass holds other people's toothbrushes and curdling water. Precision here is superfluous as cut flowers. On the seafront, the shrubs are meek in the blossoming wind. Delphine has worked on her complexion, bestowed with peaches. She's personal limelight. At night, her cruelties sneak up the ladder of her throat. It's Delphine, 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 on steamed up mirrors, always in joined up finger writing. Singing is only permitted in the dark. Delphine is judging her own obedience. Look at me being strict. But she has to remind herself of the rules hourly. Deceit is its own discipline. Today, the shrubs are insolent, waiting for adults to prepare a new game. Delphine considers ceremonial magic, but how to practice without a little magic escaping. Wish yourself into a lovely place, she thinks. Loveliness would include shrubs without such expressions. Wisdom may well have been squandered on seafronts and lipstick. So many years afraid of waste is its own waste, is her self-comfort when the light folds. Okay, and then to finish this bit, I think, a very short one. We were alone for the first time, and my heart was like a small fish caught by small boys who beat the fish to death against the side of the pier instead of throwing it back. Okay. So I wanted to write a poem that kind of dealt with the idea of the expectation that is on a woman with regards to her body. The news reported she wore her body to the event. She carried herself in her body, her person being both beyond and within her body, so to speak. Her body was engaged in the act of presenting itself. Ta-da! Announced her body. The movement of her body, it was agreed, spoke volumes. The crowd could not decide if her body was too much or too little. Some demanded that her body amend itself. The person within her body was engaged in a gnarly debate with her body, and charges of slovenliness and pride sloshed back and forth, as might wine carried by a drunk. Rare moments where her person and body reached a tentative consensus, a coalition of thought and flesh, you might say, were invariably at sea, when the sky and sun applauded her buoyancy, and the warring gave way to the shared and innate skill of staying alive.
Thank you very much, Amy. What a great way to get started. So now we'll begin the open mic part of the evening, and I'd like to welcome Simon Ritchie, please, to come up and read.
Thank you very much. I'm going to read two poems, and the first one is simply called The Book. When the book was closed, the words fell into the darkness of the closed book, pages without light, less a book now than an object like any other, a square object on a table, the light reflecting off its cover, as if the look of it, the visible, was all it could claim for itself. Inside it, the words lost their meaning, or their meaning froze in them, or so faded into the letters that the book became a book of letters only, of shapes and markings, not even a book, but a container of some kind, a box. It rested in the light as if resting in water, the light pressing on its cover, on its spine, but never entering it. Open it even for a moment, and the light would pour onto its pages, and its meaning would begin to stir. It was all readiness, all waiting, something always on the edge of becoming something else. When it was opened again, the light fell on the letters, and the words filled with meaning in a single movement. It rose from them so brightly that the words were obscured by it, one kind of light answering another. A book now of pure meaning, almost invisible, almost weightless. And the second is a very short poem. It's called In the Air Above. One evening, a seagull tilted in the sky, and the late evening sun quickly reddened its underfeathers. The coincidence of light and a passing bird and my being there, striking off one another so that beauty flared up for a moment in the air above and went out again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Simon, for that lovely image of the bird. So now we welcome Tim Stavert.
Evening, Ledbury. A year has gone by since I last performed at the Seven Stars. Now, a lot of this, some of it is meaningless year because tonight is the 4th of July, Independence Day. Funny that, isn't it? Coincidence. But make this of what you will. This is the year of 1776, when America got out of a fix, getting independent from Britain. From then they shall reign. From natives shooting with bow and arrow, to gun bombs and banks to borrow. This modern day they are power to all, but from a great height they will one day fall. Like any kingdom, they celebrate their day. With celebration they shout loudly, hooray! Banging their drums and blowing their bugles, to this day with their Facebook and Googles. Even sending rockets and men to the moon, hoping they would live there one day soon. But now, as the money begins to run out, the East is catching up fast with a clout. Look at the meaning of Independence Day. Does it sound so sinister in some way? As other countries try to compete, to battle with all, could end in defeat. Okay. This one, I love wildlife, and my garden is a haven of wildlife. And I love even the predators, and you know, we got prey, and of course the grey squirrel. And we have one which everyone that comes around we call Kev, because they have this attitude, you know, you're looking at me. Yeah, well, Kev is the squirrel, as crafty as can be, looking for food from tree to tree, waiting for us to put out some bird feed, grabbing every bit of morsel with pure greed. Coconuts, peanuts, seeds, fruit and bread, like a feast at the banquet. Oh, what a spread. Like meals on wheels up to his dray, moving so fast with such a flash of grey. Then now comes our flash bird feeder to limit the food from this fast feeder. Kev would look to his root to pounce, to enjoy his nuts and every ounce. Climbing the washing line to grab his food, I curse and swear with words so rude at this clever creature with clenched fist as he disappears, chuckling into the mist. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim. We've got a squirrel who keeps coming in our house. It's very annoying. So now we're Geoffrey. Could I welcome Geoffrey Loughman, please?
Thank you. Managed to survive that one. This is a variant on a story by M.R. James. It's called Which I Seize. Come then, for the incomparable views alone will take your breath away. Then handed the strap, with binoculars to add to the sack on my back. We booted up, filled flasks, wrapped sandwich bags, turned to Polaris. For this is Eden, this is England, he enthused, barely losing a breath as we crossed field after field, until by the beck, after the spinney, he pointed. That rise will give us view to Eden itself. Come then. I tramped slowly after, unused to such sights, blessed the brief tree shade, heard a meadow pipit's help cry, a triple feet. but over stone walls we moved through tangled sphagnums and sedge rising up. Gritstone shards flecked the way, muddy. We squelched on darkening ground. He shouted, having reached the rise. I took out my binoculars to view Eden clear. But all I saw was a gibbet, halters on the ground, and a flesh-bitten fleece on bones, swaying slightly in the breeze. And I thought, this cannot be England. From ways of seeing to different kinds of partings. This is departure. A palm held out, fingers stretch, time to linger, as if to leave will be a loss, still so much to see. We part too hurriedly, we grieve whatever we believe. Flags are folded, best books bundled, a generation's photos are packed. We map the labyrinths of our past, that our words and deeds may last, memories like furniture are stacked. Our blurred eyes try to meet, but we know what all this signifies. It's time to go. Time to go.
Thank you very much, Geoffrey. Now I'd like to welcome Diana Calvert, please.
Hello, everybody. My first poem comes out of my years of nursing in Cornwall. It's called Twilight. Only the lamp casting shadows reminds Florrie of days that are gone. She sits by her bed in an armchair, and the memory stirs of a song. White walls vanish around her. She's back in her childhood again. The dry, stifling heat of the hospital is transformed to warm summer rain. It's a song of fireflies and moonlight, and its tune is the rhythm of life. Florrie drifts back to the land of her youth, a child, a lover, a wife. She's skipping down the worn pathway that leads to the boats and the sea. Her spectacles slip as she nods her head. No need for them now that she's free. Her father is eating his pasty as she spreads worn nets on the shore. The gulls circle greedily overhead, and her spectacles drop to the floor. Church bells are ringing in Newlyn on one of those wild Cornish days, and Florrie trips lightly up the aisle while the nurses tut-tut at her ways. But the song has many long verses, and its tune is the heartbeat of love. The lamp is still casting strange shadows while Florrie is gazing above. She's showing her children a rainbow, and she reaches to lift one of them high. The nurses are saying, it's bedtime, but all Florrie can see is the sky. They put her to bed with a struggle. She doesn't know what she's done wrong. They call her a senile old nuisance, and nobody's heard of her song. The next poem I wrote after my father died in spring some time ago, and he was an atheist. The Wrong Time. Spring is such a bad time to die, to say farewell when all the sap is rising and winter's icy grip has melted into nothingness, to bow out at the beginning of things when a new old song haunts the lips of the world and the dark earth's womb is stirring. All right for the hopeful travellers who wait half gladly for an unseen cloud of faith to bear them to some far-off better harbour, but sad for those without conviction who have loved the world in all its guises. They would not choose to leave in spring. And this one I've just written because I've just been moving house. It's called Restless. A place that haunts my waking dreams comes calling me again. On winter's strangled breath, I sense its winsome touch. I reach out to possess it, but find it has no name. Nowhere yet everywhere, taunting the restless spirit to journey onwards or to lie down and forget.
Thank you very much, Diana, for those lovely images, especially the sea. I love the sea. I would now like to welcome Sue Johnson, please.
Right. Evening, everyone. I'm going to read two poems from my collection, which is called Tasting Words, Hearing Colours. The tasting words relates to synesthesia. I have lexical gustatory synesthesia, which sounds very posh, but it just means I taste words. It keeps the weight down. This first poem is about an aunt that I lived with at one time, 5 foot nothing, absolutely terrifying. And she had a collection of sayings that none of us could really make sense of. And this is one of them. Stravaging. Little girls who stravage get their north ears cut off and eat stewed slugs for dinner. I turn another somersault on the metal bar at the end of the alley. You'll get appendicitis. I think she says a pen to write with, which I'd like better than a pencil. So I do it again. Stop stravaging this minute. I want to get to the shops today. And don't try and jump that puddle. You'll splash your clean socks. See, I knew you would. I pick up a coin that somebody dropped and wait for her to go on about coins being dirty and you don't know who's touched them. It's a farthing with a wren on it. Was the wren stravaging too? I move on a stage with my own excursions to the shops, walk on the wall by the Priory Gardens, and play hopscotch on the black and white stripes of the zebra crossing, with the lollipop beacons that flash on, off, pid pod, like the beat of the metronome on my dancing teacher's piano. Did any of you like eavesdropping as a child? Hiding under tables and things like that, yeah? I used to spend a lot of time under my granny's dining table. She lived upstairs, in the upstairs of our house. It was a three-storey house, and she was upstairs. And there were all these fascinating discussions about who got various things wrong with them, and also these political meetings, which were really intriguing. And this is called Chocolate in the Bath. As a writing group exercise, we were asked to think about a childhood game played in a confined space, except that mine wasn't a game like cowboys and Indians or playing sardines. It was an exercise in observation, my early training as a writer. Gran's kitchen smelled of paraffin, bleach and lemon cake as I hid under the table, sheltered by the red chenille cloth, and watched the gathering of boots and shoes around me. I listened to the poetry of names, Chamberlain, Attlee, Shimwell and Ramsay MacDonald, and occasionally a hand would reach under the cloth and offer a ginger biscuit or a homemade jam tart. Today, we are asked to think of a way to unwind after writing. And as the images of Gran's political meetings fade, I imagine myself eating chocolate in a rose-scented bubble bath. And, says the workshop leader, think of the unlikeliest person to share this treat with. So, with eyes half closed, I try to imagine eating chocolate in the bath with Ramsay MacDonald. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. I'm sure you'll all agree we do have amazing open mics, don't we, in Ledbury? Absolutely brilliant. Right, now I'd like to welcome Bob Woodruff, please.
Hello there. I come from Evesham. That's got something to do with this first poem. We've only got two poems or 4 minutes. So what am I going to read to a politically knowledgeable, poetically knowledgeable audience like you? So here's a couple of poems you should know, but a different take on them. Do you know Robert Frost? And the one about the woods and the stopping on an evening when it was snowing. Well, this, apologies to Robert Frost, is stopping by floods on a rainy evening. Whose fields are these? I'm not quite sure, but the river's rising higher. And they won't see me drive through here, through their green fields flooded over. My 4x4 will get across. Who needs a hard road to follow? Rain has flooded these lush meadows between wood and swollen river. Other than the revving engine, the only sound, the liquid splash of water underneath the wheels, then lapping right up to the doors. The fields are flooded dark and deep, and water has begun to seep, with miles to go before I reach, with miles to go before I reach. If I could find the other one. This is Edward Thomas, but not as you know him. You know the one about the train stopping at the station? Nothing happened, blackbirds singing. If you take Adelstrop and you turn it round, you get Port Selder. Yes, I remember Port Selder, the name, because one morning the boat moored there, unscheduled due to the storm. The waves crashed, the boat rocked, no one disembarked or boarded on the windswept deck. What I saw was Port Selder from a distance, and waves, waves and rocks, and the sand and the rolling horizon. Never still, never calm, and clouds raging across the sky. And for a moment, an albatross hung above the mast, and around him gathered in great flocks half the gulls of the northern and southern hemispheres. Thank you.
Great to hear those poems by a take on poets from our area. That's really lovely. Thank you, Bob, very much for that. So now I'd like to welcome Kaz Kimbri, please.
Thanks, everybody. I attended a poetry workshop for the very first time this week. This is my very first poetry reading, so here we go. I've got three poems. One's a funny one in a strange accent, which perhaps I'll leave to the end. Let's just go for this one, which is tells you a little bit about perhaps my background. Rules are rules. Collar turned up was bad enough, but further still, the arms crept up and up beyond my elbows, tousled creases showing defiance or contempt for strict girl rules. But even more, the indignation of heels twice measured to check on someone for whom flat was always good. Sort-driven thoughts grew of how to press down and into their regime with a symbol of resistance. I chose desert boots of filthy brown and kick-scuffed leather to stand out amongst the bright black pointy kind, and then hid in line for a week. Haughty, proud, scoffing teen. Until the moment when she, in her measured pleated skirt, looked down and saw. Our eyes met and burned and pricked. but mine pricked more. This next poem is my response to the events of the last week in relation to what happened at the Somme. You may recognise the last line. Taken abroad. That man is dying over there, but the look of hope is still in his eyes. His pupils, still wet and bright, reflect the light of stars on this clear night. Strength of pride still fills his chest, forcing last breaths of air around his bleeding heart. Hot pokes of tears fall like mammoth's forest flowers into the bone-mealed, ochred earth. See now how his brow reveals a slight inflection that hints surprise. This moment has arrived so soon. Ahead, the heels of pals within his grasp. But bosky lads don't dare defy odds now. A hoit with back thumping and baccy and rum, like they did last night. Instead, he hears his own gasp of realisation, sharpened by impossible thoughts of living. His eyes turn right, just one last time, to feel between his grated fingers the touch of God's good acre. For dead men can advance no further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kaz. I hope you enjoyed your first reading. Right. So that was great, though. Now I'd like to welcome Margaret Adkins.
Well, I too have a nursing background, and my first poem comes from working for 10 years in the inner city of Birmingham as a midwife. And occasionally in that time I had some of the young ladies of the night in my care, and this is where this poem comes from. It's called Where Do You Go, Mummy? Where do you go, Mummy, when you go out not looking like you? Where do you go when you turn your neck for a kiss instead of your lips and whisper, night, night, sleep tight, and I smell marshmallows on your clothes, the clothes you hang on the back of your door and not in your cupboard? Who do you go to, Mummy, after the door clicks when I'm still not asleep and your heels clip down the stairs into the street until it is all quiet except for cars and voices passing by? Where have you gone when the wind bangs and the street lamp keeps me awake and arms scrabble at my window, scratching with scratchy fingers and toes, angry, 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 trying to get in? And through a peeping hole in the curtain, anyone can see me squeezing my eyes tight shut, trying not to smell the wet sheet. Why do you go? Shh, my lovely, I'm here, ain't I? Here now for a big cuddle in my big bed. Mummy's here for you. See, with your favourite cup of milk. Mummy's always here when you open your eyes. And, sweetheart, how can a tree hurt you? It's just a tree, silly. My next one is from my career as a nurse and a midwife, and the sadness I feel for the state of the health service now and nursing in general, and it's called The Ottoman. I take 36 years, fold them inside a sheet, and lay them on the floor of the ottoman. I take a string of paper dolls, some dying, some amputees, some pregnant, and fold them in and out until just one face looks up at me, and I lay them back to back on the worn sheet. I place all the night hours of work and no sleep and missed family Christmases in a box and lay it next to the doll of 1,000 paper faces. I see my youth bound with enthusiasm, fade where it touches holes too big to darn in the old sheet. The ottoman fills with muffled voices from others sucking on pricked fingers trying to darn, all of us crying out for thimbles. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret. I think that should be required listening, really, in Westminster. Right. So now I'd like to welcome Adam Horovitz, please.
First poem I'd like to read. It's written a little while ago on a train travelling through Dullum Thomas country on the way back. It's called To Be Read Looking Upward Over Water. Travelled home with the taste of you soft in my mouth. Spent the journey laughing easy as stream water over last scraps of ice. Breath crazed on the carriage window, its patterns condensing into a ghosted close-up of your face. Whilst a vulgar winter sun crooned hangover songs from the sea's stomach. I pressed deeper in. The train's glass membrane planted a cool kiss on my illuminated eyelids as sky blurred, slid sideways, became fathomable again. At last, the clouds pulsing from grey to silver outwards into a white semaphore, a new lexicon born from the breaking of long winter silences. To be read looking upward over water, punctuated by black dots of wading birds, wide expanses of sand and mudflats that are as skin, ecstatic under the tongue of the tide. It's quite a train journey. And the final poem. I spent Lent of this year, not that I particularly celebrate Lent, but it seemed convenient to being, along with various other people, writing 40 sonnets over the 40 days of Lent. I didn't quite manage it, but some came out. Met the person who organised this through Jill, which is why I thought I'd read one of the sonnets. This one's called Seed and Stone. And sometimes we wake tangled up like reeds in the ploughed hollows of a watered bed, the room alive with thought drift, orchid seeds dust dancing through the sun's cold morning thread. Or we rise swiftly, burrs hooked in our hair, carry last night's barbs out into the light to drop into forgetful soil. Somewhere they'll grow tall, seed someone else's slight. If time allows, we'll wrap our dreams in flesh, hang on the branch of the bed as we swell into each other, a seedscape, a mesh, a clot of longing in a pithy shell. We are not built to lie dormant, too long alone. There are so many stems to push from seed and stone.
Thank you very much, Adam. Adam's our Herefordshire Poet in Residence, and I think you will agree we're lucky to have him as our Poet in Residence for Herefordshire. So it's been good. Well, it's been fun for us. It's not over yet. So now I'd like to welcome Anne Drysdale, please.
I'm not going to do the leap. How about a poem that expresses the triumph of hope over experience? Expressed through the art of origami. I am your sensei, you are my class, and together we have mastered the Spanish box and the bog standard crane, and we are now ready, with the aid of aspiration, to make a frog. First, take your paper, any colour you like, so long as it's green. Start from a square base. Always a good idea. Finger in pocket. Pull it round and squash it over and over till you find a diamond. Then fold its little petals one by one until, voila, it's a kite. Hang on tight. Torture the legs out with a backward bend, each pre-creased like a meticulous trouser, and draw eyes where eyes should go. Guess if you don't know. Now you're ready for the third dimension. Purse your sweet lips around its paper anus. Think prince and blow. Trust me. You know it works every time. And now for a poem that invokes a spirit of triumphant elderliness. It calls on a word that I share with a friend, both of us, as old as God's dog. And it is a name for something that Andrew McMillan mentioned in his reading last night, that people can't seem to find a word to express. The word is mechantador. A silly word. A surreptitious joke between old ladies. From a French description of a Napoleonic prison ship. Méchant odeur. Tainting the onshore wind. Why do the young suppose the old don't know that vintage craft give off an emanation that hints at obsolescence and suggests an instant downgrade and a change of purpose? Don't be. Let's downgrade slowly, you and I. Equip ourselves for further voyaging. Test our unshivered timbers while we may on seas that still invite us into action. Still fighting, still avoiding telltale talc and anything suggesting lavender. Taking on board the Œillets Mignardises, Rive Gauche, Chanel, and white camellias. After a last quick check for rogue whiskers, one of us asks the all-important question. Mechantador, darling? No, you're okay. And two fine ships set sail into the street.
Thank you, Anne. I channel that, the idea of myself as a fine ship, as I leave this building. I like that. I'd like to welcome Leslie Ingram, please.
Before I start, I'm going to do a bit of a plug. I'm ever so sorry, because it's going to eat into me 4 minutes. But look, please buy it. Please buy it. It's fabulous. It's just fabulous. There's poets in here from Adamson to Zephaniah with all sorts of little memories, reminiscences, thoughts over the last 20 years of Ledbury Poetry Festival. It's £9.99. It's the cost of one ticket for one of these events. You know, it's just, and it'll last you forever. Just do it, please, because every penny goes to the festival and we want to keep it going, don't we? Anyway, right, I better crack on. But do, you know, because I might be round to check that you are doing. For many, many years, I was a stepmother. And not a part-time one, a full one. And, oh, God, it was hard. Well, it wasn't at first, then it got worse, mainly when the mum came along, but I'm not going to read poems about that time of it. I'm going to read a couple of poems from right at the beginning of the experience. And the first one is, if I can see, because I've got problems with my lenses, I might move it like that. Meeting the children. So there's meeting the son is part one, and meeting the daughter is part two of this poem. Meeting the children. One, son. You were holed up in your father's arms, a four-year-old fetus curled around his heart, watching Knight Rider with blank eyes and me with every pore.
A sudden shake, and you were on the floor, squealing in the stop-don't-stop squirm of your father's frantic tickling. And in between screams, you threw that question at the ceiling, then settled at the gentle answer. Reminded, repeated, she's not coming back. As though you needed to hear it just once more. You were sitting back against your father's chest, a four-year-old ancient sucking teeth, when you turned to me and blinked. The daughter. She was sprawled on the carpet, scrubbing in Tinkerbell with frayed felt pens, colouring her wings the grey of drained stone. "Can I see?" I asked. She came and slotted in between my thigh and the chair's arm and explained everything about fairies and Neverland. And when I asked why Tinkerbell was so sad, she said, "She's not sad. She's silver. You have to imagine the shine." The new stepmother. I have camouflaged myself rather well, I think. Napped with the smell of care and mothering things. It's not quite what I had planned, yet there it is. I have scrabbled for instincts for weeks, and the few I've gathered are unsure, untested, worn quietly, fearful of being uncovered as frauds. I'm able to frame a voice of interest, to ask the usual, to sense, and my hand, when held out, is now taken naturally for crossings and sought when walking in crowds. No one would know. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Leslie, for that plug. So now we've got Patrick Mooney.
Carry on the plug in. I'm just going to read a couple of poems from my own book in my first collection. And the first one is based on a true story. So, one day, out of the blue, a voice was heard in the distance, like a soft and gentle mouse. "Daddy, please take me walking." 15 years after taking his first steps, his voice came breaking through. We will never know why, as autism catches you out of the blue. As his soft voice echoed the words, "Mummy, I love you," everyone stood still, not knowing what to do. You could hear the silence, followed by his cheeky smile, as he gave a wink and said boo. Shopping, recycling, chocolate mousse, swing, school, music, bouncing. These are words he will say in time, but for now we will settle for what we have, and that's our Andrew. The second one is called The Hurricane. He hit the scene in 72, a sportsman in his prime. He blew the crowds away with a dazzling display. Faster than a speeding train, there was no time to slow down. Driving the crowds wild, a hurricane was in town. He could sink a ball faster than you could blink in the time it took the referee to polish the pink. As the moon rose above the Belfast sky and night turned into day, you could see the headlines as the people's champion was born. A flawed genius to this day, as the speeding train slows down. Beer and cigarettes by his side the day Alex died. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Patrick. And so I'm sad to say we're to our last poet. as part of the open mic, Jane Kermain.
I've just got one poem. It's called Midlands Kids. We were raised in the back of cars, grew up on the back seats of the long-gone marks of British manufacturing, Morris's, Austin's, Rovers and Talbots, slightly crap, even new, third or fourth hand, pockmarked, and in summer distinguished by the waft of hot leverette, the oil-black tang of four-star fumes, and the rust-red frothing of a Haddit head gasket that had sent the radiator broiling over. Those people we'd once thought to be, misplaced down the gap of the back seat that so ingeniously folded forward, or left tucked like secrets in the chrome pop-out passenger ashtray, just as each promised holiday and magical mystery tour silvered on the wing mirrors, momentarily before vanishing out on the far hot horizon, like the car plants, the company overalls, the jobs for life, the legendary square steering wheel of a paint shop fresh Allegro. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jane. So I think you'll agree it's been a splendid open mic. We're going to, I'd like to read a poem now by Horace. This was the poem I read that just made me want to bring him along to the festival. And it's called The Dimmock Bobby. As policemen come and policemen go, Bert Widdows was one of the best. He had many a friend, an occasional foe, and one or two of the rest. Tom Case was known by Bert Widdows to be a poacher by day and by night, but with the need of an occasional pheasant, to pinch him just didn't seem right. One wet and windy evening, Tom let it be known to Bert that he had a plump cock pheasant that somehow had sorter got hurt. To the Crown Inn went Bert with his cape on, all shining and dripping with rain. He said, "If I had my time over, I wouldn't be a copper again." Then someone looked out of the window and said with a kind of a grin, "There's Inspector Green outside. Do you think we should let him in?" Bert got kind of nervous and the hair stood up on his nape. Pheasant in left hand, pint in right. He hid them under his cape. The inspector said, "Evening all," and the locals rose from their seats. "Come on then," he said to Bert Widdows, "let's go and check on your beat." Down the road they walked, past Well House, and they turned by Ackrell's shop. The pheasant was dry, and so was Bert, and he hadn't spilled a drop. Through the village they walked, past the the Beecham, and down over Stillhouse Brook. They got down as far as Parent Cottage, and neither had spotted a crook. Bert's hands were getting quite tired, and so, of course, were his feet. "We'll turn here," said the inspector, "and check on the rest of your beat." Down over the Leaden they walked, and up to the top of the Lynch. Said the inspector, "It all seems quite quiet. There's nobody here to pinch." To ease his aching muscles, Bert gradually spilled his beer. But to let go of the pheasant, he said to himself, "No fear." Back over the Leaden they walked, and at the Beecham they turned to the right. The inspector said, "I've enjoyed my walk, although it's a filthy night." Bert's thoughts were somewhat different, with words I couldn't repeat. He had an empty glass in his right hand and beer stains on his feet. Back at the Crown, the inspector said, "Everything seems quite pleasant. You can drink your pint of bitter now, and I will arrest that pheasant." All true. So I'm very glad now to welcome back Amy Key for a last couple of poems. That would be wonderful. Thank you, Amy.
I'm worried I'm going to have a malfunction. You know.
No.
Okay. So I'm going to read two poems and a tiny one. So
I once had a very strange commission, which was to write a poem to inspire the design of a pair of nipple tassels. This is the poem. Brand new lover. I've abandoned vanity since I became a body of pixels, never quite set, since you rippled the apparent skin of me. I'm all texture, silk rosette, billowing coral, tentative as a just-baked cake. Sensations slide over my knitted blood. My mouth is a glass paperweight to keep our tastes in, like maraschino cherries and water from a zinc cup. This is not about a future with a decorative child. Layer your pulse onto my pulse. Dress me. This is a bit of a sad one. I recently have been caring for somebody who's suffering with addiction. And I wanted to write him a hopeful poem. Super Try Again. By now you are wearing all your drinks on your face, your emotional state a peeled egg. I had almost suggested you third person yourself, self-kindness being the emery board to a ragged worry. I held up a glass and told you to think of it as an anchor. I put it down hard on the table. The surface of the water warred a little. Please drink more water, I said. I wish you were the kind to concede to sea swimming. Remember, you told me winter is always a struggle. Remember, we have spoken like this before. And days later, you made us soup. And days later, a stranger girl made you smile on the street and you lived. And before I end, I just want to say, yeah. You want me to? Okay, maybe I'll read this one and then I'll do the tiny one. So this is a poem that is collaged from the words of Helen Gurley Brown. I don't know if any of you know who she, but she was the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine. She founded it. And also she wrote this kind of very sensational how-to guide called Sex and the Single Girl in the 60s. And it was a bit scandalous. And one of the chapters was about how to have an affair. And I was just really obsessed with the strange language that she used and the kind of kitsch of it. So this is a collage of Helen Gurley Brown's advice on how to have an affair. Nice girls do have affairs and don't necessarily die of them. Suffer, quite the contrary. One of my best friends is such a girl. It's insane not to keep your channels open, disposed by technical purity. Lack of suitable him, run aground on emotional reefs. Think, tycoon, truck driver, New York manufacturer of cosmetics. Do not suffer at all. Once in bed, it's kind of silly to fake experience. Sunny and sweet affairs are shallow and lacking in plot. Stick to unravelling chrysanthemums. If you're not sure your lovemaking is first rate, sink into a man so completely, he will never be able to unsink you. Your body wants the agony of cliff-hanging sex, and anywhere is fine as long as it's within the law. Seduce by psychiatric consultation. Conduct and ground rules, rump roasts, yes. Wall-to-wall monogrammed towels, no. You don't like your adorable kitty dragging a half-alive pigeon into your living room, but that's the nature of kitties. The end of the affair? Throw beanbags against the fireplace. Shred your lover's pulpy brain. Fail in your brazenry. It's got to be better than life stable as four-year-old peanut butter, drastically trapped by inhibitions. It's no talent to be a loving little stoic. Think, tonight, boy, I'm gonna get laid. I wouldn't take any of her advice. She's a terrible woman. Yeah, it was really lovely to hear everyone's poems. I felt like a bit of a fraud, really, being up here doing the longer reading when you're all so fabulous. I'm going to finish with this tiny poem. I do not need the sea to love me back. I went to the sea. It was a nearby calamity.
Thank you very much, Amy. I have to say, Amy was at our voice coaching workshop over a year ago now, and we had a reading at the end, and it was absolutely wonderful. But we only got, you know, a couple of poems. It wasn't very long, and so I've waited a very long time to hear Amy read again, and I'm sure you'll all agree with me. Splendid. Thank you very much, Amy. So, have what is called the open mic version of an encore. And that is when the people that hadn't managed to get themselves signed up get a chance to come and read. So, starting with you, seeing as you've... So this is our version of an encore. We've got our last 5 minutes.
Right. Thank you very much. Well, yesterday I had the privilege of actually reading a poem for a friend whose grandfather was celebrating his 100th year. I wrote a poem about an encounter he had when he was very young, which made him enter into the Air Force. And he spent his entire life working in the Air Force. So this is called The Young Man from Hilgi. A young man from Hilgi, staring at the sky, as breezes blow gently across the fields of rye. A distant smoke blowing, the London train returns. His yearning for leaving, like its coal fire, burns. The young man is walking slowly by the rail, up to the platform, cloaked in steamy veil. Then, out of the vapor, a man steps tall and proud. His dark blue regalia marked him from the crowd. Beneath the visor, a face he knew from yore, but of his aspect, more esteemed than before. So this near stranger, our Hilgi man, approached, and of his attire, the subject that he broached. My blue apparel, I've joined the Air Force Royal. Do Great Britannia, no other force more loyal. To join this brethren, a choice I scarcer rue, ascending to heaven, up to the central blue. And from this discussion, an entire future formed. Soon, at his homestead, his mother was informed. A life in the service, in the royal air. A life full of meaning, of moments, rich and rare. A century onward, surrounded by his kin, blessed by life richer than most of mortal men. Each generation behold with loving eye the old man from Hilgi smiling at the sky.
So thank you everyone for coming. It's been a real pleasure to hear all your different poems. I think you'll all agree it's been a really, really superb festival open mic this year. I've really enjoyed it. And of course, we shall all be looking forward to next year. Yay!